He needs a dummy or a puppet with movable jaws to help to create his illusion and to distract the attention of the audience from the slight movements of his own facial muscles, which are inevitable because he is using his own voice. As for my supposed talent for mimicry, literally thousands of different voices of discarnate persons have been tape-recorded for posterity, speaking in different dialects, in foreign languages unknown to me and even in languages no longer spoken on this earth. So I think mimicry as a theory does not hold even one drop of water. When all other theories have been found to be untenable, a cast iron skeptic will not hesitate to suggest that downright fraud explains the phenomena of the voices. It has been hinted that I might have a two-way voice channel to another room where accomplices mimic the voices of the departed, or that I might conceal tape recorders which play previously prepared messages from the dead. There is no end to the ingenious tricks which have been dreamt up by those determined not to believe and who, more often than not, have never even had a sitting with me. If I were to pay any attention to the nonsense talked by such silly and obdurate persons, I might with justice ask them how these hidden accomplices or concealed tape recorders can hold long two-way conversations with sitters, in which a mass of personal detail and reminiscence on the part of the discarnate entity builds up irrefutable evidence of his or her continued existence. I could also ask these stubborn cynics how these supposed accomplices of mine, however skilled in their mimicry, contrived to reproduce the recognizable voice of a wife, a husband or other dead relative of a sitter, who may have only just arrived from Australia, India or even Timbuktu. I do not, however, waste my time or my precious energies exchanging words with these skeptics, who are as ill-informed as they are prejudiced. I and the many thousands who have sat with me know the truth. When war broke out and I turned down the kind offer of refuge in America for the duration of hostilities, I imagine my feelings as I did so were akin to those of Caesar refusing the crown of Rome. Because ever since I was a film-struck and star-struck small boy, there was no country I longed more ardently to visit. And so I was overjoyed when, in the summer of 1949, I was given another chance to visit America. After the initial shock of discovering that £5 was the total amount I would be permitted to take with me, and once the flurry of getting visas, guarantors and medical certificates was over, I settled Edith in with her daughter for the duration of my trip and I sailed for New York. Picture text page 209, Leslie around the time of his first visit to the USA. 12. The Queen Mary was still a beautiful ocean liner, but years of wartime trooping had left her shabby and run down, a tired and aging lady badly in need of a facelift. We were three in a small cabin and I did not need to be psychic to sense the hatred between the two other men. One was German, the other was a Polish Jew, and neither spoke English nor the language of the other. Non-communication was total, except for the implacable loathing which filled our cabin like a live and malevolent thing. During the 5 days of the voyage I wondered what personal tragedy each man might have left behind him, in the post-war chaos of his country, which could have bred such malignance. One morning after we had been at sea for a couple of days, a steward knocked on the cabin door. Before I had time to escape the oppressive miasma surrounding my roommates and into the fresh air on deck, he entered the cabin. "The captain presents his compliments to you, Mr. Flint," began the steward politely. "He wonders if you would be good enough to take the Holy Communion service on Sunday at 11? The notion that such an august person as the captain should know I even existed was dumbfounding enough, let alone his curious request. I suppose I must have stood stupidly open-mouthed, trying to work it out. "You are down on the passenger list as a minister of religion," said the steward with a patient sigh. "Will you take the service?" "Of course not," I blurted out. "I'm not that kind of minister at all." The steward heaved a bigger and even more patient sigh and left, clearly wondering what kind of a nut I was. I wondered why I had listened to Father Sharp when he had instructed me on how to complete my passport application. On the morning of our 5th day at sea we sailed into American waters, and there ahead of us was the Statue of Liberty and the thrilling skyline of New York City. In the Customs and Immigration building I was hit by a sudden panic. Suppose the friends who had invited me to America failed to meet me? I had no money except for the paltry remains of my £5 and no prospect of earning any. I would be stranded in a strange country without even the price of a bed at night. The cavalier treatment given out by the customs official did nothing to reassure me. By way of searching for contraband, he simply turned my neatly packed case upside down so that the entire contents just fell on the ground. He rummaged through them and I was left to repack. When he was finished with me, in my imagination I was already haggard, unkempt and panhandling for dimes on Skid Row. As soon as I emerged from customs, the warmth of my friend's welcome banished my hungry panhandler persona to the recesses of my consciousness. When I saw the apartment my friends had rented for me, my heart sank. This temporary home of mine consisted of an entire floor of one of the old brownstone houses in West 88th Street, once a smart residential district of New York, but at that time had fallen on less prosperous days. The furnishings of the apartment seemed to me the epitome of extravagant comfort, and the bathroom was the biggest and most luxurious I had ever seen in my life. I immediately began to fret about how I was going to pay for it all, but before my worries gave me an ulcer I learned that I was the guest of the Reverend Mrs. Bertha Marks, noted medium and the head of the Waitstead Memorial Center. This was a spiritualist society which occupied the ground floor of the brownstone house and was named in memory of Waitstead, editor, reformer and spiritualist who was lost at sea in the disaster of RMS Titanic. Dear Bertha Marks, she not only provided me with a roof over my head, she organized my workload and introduced me to many of the best-known spiritualists in America. In every way in her power she made my stay in New York a happy and memorable one. I also made a new and delightful friend in Caroline Chapman. Known as Chappie, she was one of the most loved mediums in America, as well as one of the few whose psychic gifts were endorsed by the American Society for Psychical Research, which is just as tough and just as skeptical as its British counterpart. I loved New York and I spent many hours just walking its streets, discovering it, getting the feel of it. Sometimes I got lost in its great confusion and it took me a while to master the subway sufficiently to get on a train going in the right direction. But even getting lost was fun in that city of inidiresis negation night variety. The most impressive spirit communications are those in which information is given by a discarnate person which is unknown to anyone present, and is sometimes even rejected as untrue, but after subsequent inquiry proves it to be correct. Such a communication rules out the overworked theory of telepathy and can be regarded not merely as evidence of survival, but as cast iron proof. Such a communication was given at a seance I held for 75 persons at the Stead Memorial Center, and the American recipient was a Mr. Robert F. Bolton, then living at 40 East 49th Street in New York City. After various spirits had spoken to their friends, Mickey announced the presence of one who was known on Earth as Carl Schneider. No one in the room responded, apparently no one knew him. Mickey persisted, declaring someone in the room knew Carl Schneider and that the person must speak up to help him communicate. "I know a man of that name," said Mr. Bolton, finally, "but to the best of my knowledge he is alive and well." Undaunted, Mickey asserted that Carl Schneider was on the other side and he was about to speak. Carl's voice was then heard and he and Mr. Bolton conversed. "When did you pass away?" inquired Mr. Bolton. "About 12 months ago, maybe a little over a year," the spirit replied. "It was Carl's voice," declared Mr. Bolton after the seance. "I recognized its unmistakable husky quality." Mr. Bolton found the spirit return of his friend Carl Schneider so totally unexpected he was in a state of agitation, until he could conidiresis negation RM whether his friend was alive or dead. On the morning after the seance, the first thing he did was to call the telephone number which Carl had once given him. When the phone was answered, he asked to speak to Carl Schneider and the answer came, "I am sorry, but Carl passed away." Because he still could not believe it, Mr. Bolton then asked, "Are you sure?" The voice at the other end of the line replied, "I ought to be." I am the one who found him. He committed suicide about a year ago. When Robert Bolton attended another group seance of mine, Mickey singled him out to tell him his friend Carl was glad he had checked up, because now he would know the truth of survival. My account of Mr. Bolton's experience is taken from a letter which Mr. Bolton wrote, completely unsolicited, to Psychic News in London, describing what happened at that group seance. In his letter, Mr. Bolton, in assessing the value of his experience, comments, "I am not so naive as to believe this account will cause belief in the spirit world to come as a revelation to a scoffing skeptic. This report, however, may inspire some honest skeptic to expose himself to the possibility of such an experience. It is the only scientific approach to truth." Too soon I had to leave New York for Chicago, where a big public demonstration had been organized for me at the Kimball Hall. When I sallied forth from my hotel on my first evening there to take a look at the city, almost the first thing I saw was my old friend B. Lilly's name in lights over the entrance to a theater. She was starring with Ray Bolger in Hey! Hey! USA, and I went to see the show. I enjoyed it enormously, and B and Ray together made me laugh so much it hurt. I went around after the performance and found B the same charming and friendly person as ever, in spite of her fabulous success in the States and all the adulation it had brought her. When I turned up at the Kimball Hall the following evening to give my demonstration, I was met with a bombshell. My sponsors had arranged to borrow a cabinet for me from another medium, but the medium had left town and the cabinet was still locked in his apartment and no one had the keys. Furthermore, it was impossible to darken the hall and every ticket had been sold, every seat was filled and they were standing in the aisles. "Give them a lecture and follow it with clairvoyance," said one of my sponsors with what I thought was maddening calmness. I told him it was years since I had given clairvoyance in public, but without a word this incurable optimist just pointed to the packed ranks of the audience who were waiting for the famous London medium to appear. Even if I were to give a lecture followed by clairvoyance, what would be the reaction of an audience who had paid for a demonstration of direct voice? My confident friend thought they would understand once we had explained it to them, and to my amazement, they did. When I walked onto the platform, I was greeted by warm-hearted applause. Almost at once I had thoughts and impressions come flooding into my mind and I started to speak. I finished my lecture to applause, and with my self-confidence restored and the butterflies in my stomach at rest, I began my clairvoyance. If I may use the term in this context, it was a brilliantly executed performance. For one solid hour the evidence simply poured out of me. Not one name went unrecognized, not one message went unclaimed. Apart from the pleasure of giving happiness to the recipients, it was sheer joy for me to discover this facet of my mediumship was still able to function so well. When I left my hotel the next morning to go sightseeing, I was surprised to be stopped in the streets by complete strangers who wanted to thank me for evidence they had been given. Some pleaded with me to sit for them privately, but I had to disappoint them all because I was soon to be on my way to Los Angeles. I had been invited to LA by Dr. Carl Menyuk to be a guest at his Long Beach apartment, where I had agreed to hold seances for a few of his friends. Our only contact had been by correspondence, so when I arrived at Los Angeles station I looked around for a cozy family doctor type of man who might be my host. I saw no one who fitted this description, so I stood around trying to look like the famous medium from London by gazing Luidiris's negation Y into the middle distance, while wishing fervently that I had worn a quiet tie. Shortly I was greeted by a man no older than myself who introduced himself as Carl Menyuk. His doctorate, I later learned, was in philosophy. Perhaps the most dramatic seance I held in Los Angeles was one at which a father returned to tell his son the truth about his death and to exonerate the driver of the vehicle which killed him. The son, whom I will call Bill, was brought with his wife to a group seance by their friend Miss Artie Blackburn of Los Angeles. All Miss Blackburn had told me about these friends was that the husband Bill was a brilliant inventor and scientist, who would analyze any evidence he might receive and would refuse to accept anything which could not be proved. At the sitting, Mickey spoke to Bill and asked if he was associated with the Texaco Corporation. Bill answered that he was, but he supposed Miss Blackburn had given me this information previously. Both Mickey and Miss Blackburn stoutly denied this, and in fact, I never allow friends of sitters to give me any information about them. Not only would it render any evidence which may come valueless, but I have found that when someone inadvertently gives me information before a sitting, it makes me so self-conscious that the sitting is just as likely to be a blank. Was your father killed very suddenly in an accident? Was Mickey's next question to Bill, who said this was correct. What is La Brea? Asked Mickey next. It's the name of the bus which killed my father, was Bill's reply. I learned that it is the practice of some passenger vehicle operators in the States to name their vehicles. Your dad says it wasn't the driver's fault as you all thought. He says you sued the company, which was too bad, because it was all his own fault. He thought he was agile enough to get across ahead of the bus. He says the driver hadn't a chance, but it wasn't his fault at all. Prompted by the voice of Bill's father, Mickey then went on to describe the exact circumstances of the accident. Then he suddenly changed the subject. Your dad is saying that you didn't do what he wanted with his Masonic watch and chain. Bill, rather hurt, replied that he had given it to a friend of his father's, thinking that was what his father wished. You gave him the watch, said Mickey, but what about the chain? Then Bill's wife chipped in. Oh, dear, she said, I kept the chain, I wanted to wear it myself. The next message Mickey relayed from Bill's father was to ask him not to visit the cemetery so often. Your dad says you take flowers from his own garden to put on his grave, but he would rather see them growing than placed on a grave when he isn't there. It was true that Bill took flowers to the grave from his father's own garden, because he and his wife were now living in his father's former home. What about your dad's stick? Mickey asked. My father never walked with a stick in his life, answered Bill. Undaunted, Mickey replied, well, he's talking about the stick he kept in the chest. He went around with it at night, rapping on doors and locks to see everything was fastened up tight. Oh, that stick, said Bill, it's still in the chest. Afterwards, when Bill was asked what he thought of the sitting, he said, this is the most wonderful night of my life. This is the night my spiritual unfoldment begins. On a subsequent evening, Bill had another sitting with me, and on that occasion his father was able to speak directly to him and his wife, in a voice which Bill recognized as his father's own. I had got used to the way their warm-hearted Americans telephoned complete strangers like myself to offer hospitality, so I was not unduly surprised when a Mr. Robert Lefevre suggested driving me to Hollywood to spend the day with his wife and himself. Hollywood, the very name of it uttered casually on the telephone by a stranger, was enough to thrill me with memories of past enchantments at the cinema. In spite of the years which had passed, at heart I was still the star-struck boy, in the four-penny seats at the cinema. As we drove along Sunset Boulevard and began the climb into Beverly Hills, Mr. Lefevre told me he and his wife had recently sold their chain of hotels in San Francisco and bought a Hollywood home for their retirement. It once belonged to the film star Rudolph Valentino, said my new friend. Did you ever hear of him? An echo from years before came to mind, as I recalled the voice of Valentino. One day when he is a famous medium, he will hold a seance in the room which was my bedroom in my house in Hollywood, and I will come to speak to him there. Then I saw a sign by the road which said Falcon Lair, and the car turned off towards the house. It was a charming house, and Mr. and Mrs. Lefevre were the kindest of hosts, so when they asked me to hold seances for them and a few of their friends, I was happy to agree. When they asked me to choose a room in which to hold the seances, I said I thought the room opening off the patio would be most suitable, and it did not surprise me at all when Mr. Lefevre remarked, that room used to be Valentino's bedroom. Valentino came through at the first seance at Falcon Lair, and almost the first thing he said after greeting us was how happy it made him to be able to fulfill the promise he had made to me so many years before. He thanked Mr. and Mrs. Lefevre for inviting me and told them he was glad they were happy in his old home, but he was afraid they would be selling it again before long. This brought a gasp from Mr. Lefevre, since he had acquired the house only a few months previously and intended to make it the headquarters of a world peace movement. Valentina must have sensed Mr. Lefevre's uneasiness, because he quickly assured him there was no unpleasantness impending. He said the Lefevres would continue their work for world peace in the house for a short time, then they would simply prefer to live elsewhere and they would sell Falcon Lair. Picture text page 231, an unusual photograph taken during Leslie's seance in Valentino's former home of Falcon Lair. After the seance we sat in the big drawing room of the house with the curtains open and we could see the whole of Hollywood spread out before us. It was a glitter of lights, romantic and beautiful in the distance. I found it hard to believe I was really sitting in Rudolph Valentino's drawing room looking out over the Idiarus's Negation LM city, just as he must have done so many times in his life. As I sat marveling, suddenly I knew with certainty that Valentino had never been happy in this house, nor would anyone else ever be happy in it. Months later, when I was back in London, someone sent me an article from a Los Angeles newspaper which said the Lefevres had sold Falcon Lair to Doris Duke, the tobacco heiress, and they had moved elsewhere. I made another vicarious contact with Valentino when I met Mae Murray. In the days of silent films, Mae was MGM's most glamorous star, the uncrowned queen of Hollywood. Her blonde curls, beast-tongue mouth and lithe dancer's figure fascinated the jazz age generation. It brought her riches, fame and adulation, but the coming of Sound Pictures and a disastrous marriage to Prince David and Ivani toppled her from her throne. When I met her, she was living in circumstances sadly reduced from the days when her Rolls Royce had solid gold and cloison fittings and sable rugs. Mae was still vividly attractive and she was a joy to be with, because of her delicious sense of humor and a complete lack of self-pity. Although I think few women have been so dishonestly exploited as Mae was in the days when her name on any film brought in revenue at the box office. It was Mae and her first husband, the director Bob Leonard, who had given Valentino his first chance as a leading man in films, at a time when he was an unknown dancer on the fringes of the film industry. From then on, a true and deep friendship had grown up between Mae and Valentino, which endured until his untimely death. Talking to Mae and listening to her stories about Valentino, I came more and more to know and admire the good and gentle man behind the screen image of the great lover. I also saw my friend Mae West, who invited me to her Hollywood penthouse, which was in a huge block of luxury apartments known as Ravenswood Apartments. Mae not only lived there, she owned the whole block, for unlike many big stars, she is an excellent businesswoman and over the years she has invested her enormous earnings wisely and well. I found the decor of her home startling, to say the least. It was almost entirely white. Walls, carpets, curtains, furniture, everything was white, with occasional splashes of dramatic color here and there, a spray of scarlet flowers in a white bowl or a jade cushion on a white settee. It all seemed to be designed to highlight and dramatize a life-size statue of Mae in the nude, which dominated the room. As a setting for Mae's blonde good looks and vivid personality, it was superb. But I could not help feeling homesick for Edith and the shabbiness of my home on Sydney Grove. The day before I left Hollywood was the anniversary of Valentino's death, so I made a sentimental journey to Hollywood Memorial Park Cemetery to put some flowers on his grave. When I found his white marble mausoleum, it was already heaped with blooms. A cemetery attendant told me that even though it was more than 20 years since his death, tributes from all over the world had been arriving at the cemetery all day. The attendant pointed out a vase in the crypt which held 13 roses, 12 red, 1 white, and then told me I had just missed seeing the lady in black. This was the name given to the mystery woman, in deep mourning, who visited the tomb with the 13 roses on each anniversary of the star's death. Some years after my near encounter with the lady in black, she herself revealed the story behind her annual pilgrimage to Memorial Park. Because it throws light on a side of Valentino's nature with which the public was not familiar, I will briefly retell the story here. The lady in black was a violinist and pianist, and her name was Dittora Flame. She had met Valentino in 1918 when he was poor and unknown and trying to make a career as a dancer. Dittre was then 14 years old. Soon after their meeting, she became gravely ill and was sent to hospital. The child was frightened that she would die and was obsessed by the idea that no one would care or remember her when she was dead. Valentino spent hours at her bedside, comforting her and trying to give her the will to live. Each time he came to see her, he brought red roses, which at that point in his career he must have struggled to afford. One day he found her crying and insisting that death was near, and she told him she would end up lonely and forgotten in her grave. Valentino promised that if she were to die, he would bring red roses to her grave every day. "But remember," he added, "if I die first, I don't want to be lonely or forgotten either." Well, Valentino did die first, but Dittre never forgot. Although letters from home had been unfailingly cheerful, I began to feel uneasy about Edith's health, and as soon as I returned to New York, I booked my passage back home on the Queen Mary. When I walked into our sitting room in Sydney Grove, the way Edith's face lit up when she saw me was my reward for cutting short my stay in America. She was sitting in a chair by the open window, and since it was a warm summer's day, I wondered why she had a blanket draped over her knees. When I knelt by her side to hold her hands and ask her all the questions that crowded into my mind, I discovered the reason for the blanket. Edith was hoping to conceal from me, for as long as possible, that she was in a wheelchair. When Edith saw my face, she knew, as she always did know, what was on my mind, and she smiled, almost the old radiant smile. "I love my chair, darling," she said. "I can get about so marvelously, into the garden, everywhere." Later that night, I called to see Edith's doctor and asked him to tell me the truth about my wife's health. He told me Edith had suffered another minor stroke during my absence and it was unlikely she would ever walk again. When I asked the inevitable question, he gave his opinion that my wife would not live longer than 2 years at most. I became determined that they would be two of the happiest years of her life. While I had been away, the Temple of Light Committee had organized a heavy schedule for me. There were big meetings arranged in London, Birmingham, Leeds, Liverpool and many other towns and cities, and these were to be held in halls or theatres holding up to 2,000 people. I have never owned a car, but whenever it was possible to get a train home after these meetings, I would dash to the station to catch it, no matter how late it was. When I arrived, I would make a pot of tea and take it on a tray up to our bedroom, where Edith and I would drink it together while I told her everything. I would tell her about the evidence which had come through at the meeting and all the amusing little happenings. I would look forward all day, in whatever strange town or city I happened to be, to our late night talks. Bill's affection for Edith was expressed by his constant care for her comfort and in his efforts to create imaginative and tasty meals to tempt her appetite. I would sometimes make arrangements with the manager of the local cinema, and Bill and I would take Edith in her wheelchair to see Odysseus Negation LM. She loved these outings. They made her feel part of ordinary life and it cheered her enormously. At one of my large meetings at the Kingsway Hall, a spirit with an urgent desire to communicate with his parents found a way to do so, even though his parents were not present among the audience of 2,000. A number of messages had been relayed when Mickey spoke of the presence of a young man, who refused to give his name, but who described how he had taken his own life. His parents had been at the Empire Theatre in Hackney at the time, so he was alone at home. "It was done in a mad moment. I regret it now," said the young man. "They came back from the Empire and found me hanging from the banisters. Immediately a man named Mr. Shedd, who was sitting in the auditorium, remembered meeting a man a few weeks before who had told him of his son's inexplicable suicide. The circumstances matched those described by the spirit communicator, and Mr. Shedd called out, 'I know about that boy. I met his father recently and he told me about his son's death.' Mickey returned to speak to Mr. Shedd. 'The boy is desperately anxious for his parents to know he is alive and that he is sorry for causing them such grief. Will you tell them?' Mr. Shedd agreed and promised that he would. At this same meeting, another suicide manifested to express regret for what he had done. Mrs. Bullock of Kenton was greeted by the voice of her husband, and he spoke of being accompanied by a young man whose name he gave. Mickey chipped in to fill in some details. The young man was in the home guard, and he wants you to tell his mother how sorry he is for what he did.